It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
U.S. says Russia firing at Ukrainian forces and death toll from Israel-Gaza conflict surpasses 700. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. The United States is again accusing Russia of meddling in eastern Ukraine, this time by launching rockets at Ukrainian forces from the Russian side of the border. VOA's Jeff Seldon has more from the Pentagon.
In eastern Ukraine, tanks move into position as Ukrainian troops prepare for another confrontation with Russian-backed separatists. Now, officials in Washington say they have additional proof that those separatists are getting more help from Moscow. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf.
We have new evidence that the Russians intend to deliver heavier and more powerful multiple rocket launchers to the separatist forces in Ukraine, and have evidence that Russia is firing artillery from within Russia to attack Ukrainian military positions.
A U.S. defense official confirmed the intelligence, saying the Russian military has been firing rockets into Ukraine for several days. He called it a clear escalation. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Israeli strikes in Gaza continued Thursday, and rockets fired by Hamas-led fighters in the enclave landed in Israel as both sides maintain their conditions for a ceasefire. VOA's Scott Bobb reports from Jerusalem. The number of Palestinians killed in the conflict surpassed 700, while the death toll in Israel rose to 35.
Israeli forces bombarded targets in the Gaza Strip, and Hamas-led fighters in Gaza launched rockets and mortar shells on Israel. Gaza health officials say an Israeli shell slammed into a UN-run school in the northern Gaza Strip, killing at least 15 people and injuring dozens more. The UN has confirmed the school at Beit Hanun was hit, but could not confirm the number of casualties. After meeting with British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Hamas militants are using Palestinian civilians as human shields and complained Israel is being criticized for defending itself. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
France has sent a military unit to secure the wreckage of an Air Algérie plane that crashed in Mali on its way from Burkina Faso to Algeria with 116 people on board. President François Hollande's office said in a statement today, the plane, which was carrying 51 French nationals, was clearly identified, even though it has disintegrated. There's been no reports of survivors. The White House says it is delighted that a Sudanese woman sentenced to death for refusing to give up her Christianity is now safe and free and coming to the United States. Miriam Yahya Ibrahim arrived in Rome Thursday with her husband, who is a U.S. citizen, and their two young children. They include an infant daughter born while Ibrahim was in prison. She met at the Vatican with Pope Francis, who thanked her for her faith and courage. U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice says the United States will draw strength from Ibrahim's example when supporting those denied freedom of religion. The U.S. State Department says a computer glitch will delay passports and visas being issued from its embassies around the world. Officials in Washington say the computer glitch discovered on Saturday potentially could leave millions of people waiting for U.S. travel documents. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf said the problem is worldwide and not specific to any country, documents, or visa category. She says it will stall the issuance of U.S. passports, visas, and reports of Americans born abroad. The presidents of three Central American countries will meet with U.S. President Barack Obama today to discuss the crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border, where tens of thousands of child migrants have been detained in recent months. President Obama invited the leaders of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to the high-profile meeting at the White House to address the surge of migrants fleeing poverty and violence in their countries. The Honduran and Guatemalan leaders met with members of Congress Thursday in advance of the White House meeting. Speaking with U.S. House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez said the crisis is a result of crime and poverty in Central America, as well as failures in the U.S. legal system. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 25th, and here are some of the stories we are following. The UN accuses Sudan and Malawi of civil and political rights violation.
There's quite wide use of the death penalty in Sudan, including against juveniles for crimes that cannot be considered among the most serious.
Jared Newman is a member of the UN Human Rights Committee. The UN says there is a proliferation of small arms trafficking through Cameroon. Rwanda has a new prime minister after the former was dismissed. Nigeria's trade minister says his country is attractive to investors. And Liberia celebrates 167th independence anniversary tomorrow amid Ebola and economic challenges.
You cannot stop celebrating the 102nd anniversary of your grandmother because she spoke. Even though we got challenges along the way, but there have been some gains since our Civil War, and we should be able to recognize that.
Jeremiah Solonte is Liberia's ambassador to the United States, and we'll profile a Ugandan who is fighting big business to bring slow food to Africa. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations human rights experts accuse Sudan and Malawi of failing to protect their citizens' civil and political rights. The two countries are among six that came under the investigative eye of the UN Human Rights Committee, which monitors the implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The 18 independent experts say they have engaged in a constructive dialogue with Sudan, but they clearly are disappointed by the country's record of abuse. They say Sudan has many laws and practices that go against its obligations under the international covenant, guaranteeing its citizens' civil and political rights. Committee member Gerald Neumann says the government justifies this by saying its interpretation of religion takes precedence over its obligations under the treaty. He says Sudan's use of the death penalty also breaches the treaty.
There's quite wide use of the death penalty in Sudan, including against juveniles for crimes that cannot be considered among the most serious. And even they maintain the death penalty for things that should not be subject to criminal prosecution at all.
The independent experts also expressed concern about the practice of torture and ill-treatment, as well as the system of secret detention centers, which are used to extract confessions. The experts say Sudan's numerous conflicts are a source of many human rights problems in the country. They have asked Sudan to return in 3 years to report on its implementation of the committee's recommendations. In a welcome development, Malawi has, for the first time since it became a party to the treaty in 1993, submitted a report to the committee for examination. While the committee is pleased with Malawi's action, that has not blunted its criticism of the country's human rights record. Chairman Nigel Rodley says the committee is concerned by extrajudicial killings in Malawi. He says the government must do much more to end torture. Rodley says child abuse is rampant and Malawi's laws must be amended to properly tackle this problem.
A particular rule of law has a corroboration rule which basically assumes that children lie, unlike grown-ups, and that therefore any testimony of children has to be corroborated by witness testimony.
The committee also is critical of the practice of forced and child marriages, harmful traditional practices such as female genital mutilation, domestic violence, and the criminalization of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex relations. It has asked Malawi to report on the implementation of its recommendations in 2018, when it is due to provide the committee with its next periodic report. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
United Nations and regional disarmament groups say small arms are spreading at an alarming rate through Cameroon to Nigeria and the Central African Republic, where they are fueling conflicts. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Experts from the United Nations and the Regional Center for Small Arms and Light Weapons in Nairobi, Kenya, say small arms proliferation is a particular scourge feeding conflict throughout Africa. In a 2014 report, experts blame small arms availability for violent escalations of civil conflict. Kenyan-born Joseph Dan Masanu of the UN Disarmament Program says through 2013, African countries spent a staggering $18 billion annually as a result of armed conflicts in 20 African states, including the Central African Republic, Nigeria, and South Sudan.
Small arms has been a big challenge to the continent because they are in the hands of civilians. They cause damage, loss of life and all that. You've seen weapons moving from Libya into the sub-Saharan part of the continent, and it is serious.
African Youth Forum for Peace co-founder Ngalim Eugene agrees many small arms have come from Libya since the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi 3 years ago. He says transit routes bring them through conflict-prone Sudan and Chad to Nigeria and the Central African Republic, but now they are showing up in Cameroon's seaport Douala.
It's a serious security issue for Cameroon. These are all kinds of arms you could find. These are all small arms, and these are the arms that are highly used by armed gangs.
Stella Ward of the UN Program Against Small Arms explains that in the Karamoja region, along the border with Ethiopia, Sudan, Kenya, and Uganda, they are engaging local women who are having some access in influencing their husbands.
Instead of encouraging their men to go and fight, they've instead called on their men to sit down, discuss peace, and put down their arms. And as a result, we are seeing a lot of arms being surrendered to the government. And we can say this region is becoming more and more peaceful because of the role of women.
Ward says more needs to be done to stop arms producers like China, Israel, and Russia from selling arms which end up in the hands of rebel movements. Without better international controls, traditionally unstable African countries see brutal escalations of conflict throughout the population. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Rwandan Prime Minister Pierre Damien Habumuremyi has been dismissed and Anastasi Murekezi appointed to replace him. Nick Long reports from Kigali on what may have prompted the change in leadership.
While the decision to replace the Prime Minister is not officially described as a dismissal, that is how it has been reported in local media, and there's been no official denial that Habumuremyi was in effect fired on Wednesday. The new Prime Minister, Anastase Murekezi, was sworn in Thursday, along with several new ministers. Afterwards, President Paul Kagame said the cabinet shake-up did not mean the replaced members were lacking in capabilities or achievements, and added they would continue to serve in other offices. There had been media reports outside Rwanda that police were investigating the former Prime Minister for possible links to the Rwandan rebel group FDLR, based in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Kigali journalist and commentator Gonzaga Muganwa has been following this story.
There is unverified allegations that one of the Prime Minister's relatives, who was in the FDLR, returned to the country without passing through the demobilization process. And the allegation says that the Prime Minister could have been aware of that and did not take appropriate steps.
But there has been no official confirmation of any such investigation. Formerly the Education Minister, Habumuremyi had been Prime Minister since 2011. His departure was unexpected, says Gonzaga.
According to the media and the public, he was considered to be very active. When compared to the previous Prime Minister, the one he had replaced, Habumuremyi was very active. He was very engaging on Twitter, on social media, he could engage the public and so on. So people had not expected it would be removed so quickly.
The new Prime Minister, Anastase Murekezi, has raised his profile on Twitter since Wednesday, when he had 167 followers. By Thursday morning, that figure had jumped to more than 2,000. Mr. Murekezi has a background as an agricultural engineer and was previously the Public Service and Labour Minister, and before that, Agriculture Minister. He becomes President Paul Kagame's third Prime Minister since 2000 and the country's 10th since 1960. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Friday, July 25th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Nigeria's industry, trade and investment minister says there is a strong appetite for both local and international businesses to invest in his country. Despite the security challenges facing the country, Olusegun Olutoyin Aganga says recent measures, including subsidies and incentives, have created a business-friendly environment. Aganga tells reporter Peter Clotty that the government has taken steps to address the challenges confronting businesses.
If you want to ask the questions, what the investment appetite is, I will be saying that it's huge. And that's driven by the many, many opportunities in the country. It's also driven by, of course, money follows money, by the level of return on investment. When you look at the capital markets, we delivered about 35% in 2012, 47% in 2013. The macroeconomic environment is actually very strong and very stable. When you look at the policies of government, this particular government is driven by a number of transformational policies that are actually encouraging investors to come into different sectors of the economy. But the final point I want to make is just a general rule also, that if you look at what investors need the capital, they need the technical know-how. That's the second point. They need the raw materials if you're investing in the real sector of the economy. They also need a market to sell to.
Some people have expressed concern about the power generation, which some people say is an inhibitor, if I may put it that way. How are you addressing those concerns?
You see, the power situation, yes, is curtails investments. But when you look at the history, countries have been operating in this country for decades, and the return on investment remains as high as 35.5%. So what that tells is that there are ways around that, which the bigger companies have actually done. They've gone around that. So all the companies you see today operating in the country today, they operate in the same environment. Yes, the lack of power makes the cost of production higher, but that's made up for by government incentives to start with, which is very generous to investors. It's made up for because of the cost of labor and raw material, which is quite low, and the market. So that offsets that. However, I think this is one government that in 53-year history of this country has privatized power generation and power distribution to address the issue of power.
Nigeria is full of entrepreneurs. Any part of the world you go to, you see Nigerians, entrepreneurs everywhere. How are you attracting them back home?
I was one of the Nigerians in diaspora. I was in the United Kingdom for about 30 years. I only came back in 2010. And I must tell you that since then, and even before then, we've seen quite a large number of people come back from abroad, from whether US or Europe and all that.
Olusegun Olutoyin Aganga is Nigeria's industry, trade and investment minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. We reported yesterday that the Liberian government had made proper representation to the U.S. Embassy in Liberia, seeking clarification on why the visas of three senior Liberian government officials were revoked after they had left the country. The three officials are Associate Justice of the Supreme Court Kabina Jane, Youth and Sports Minister Eugene Nambe, and Senator Geraldine Doe Sharif. Well, the U.S. Embassy in Liberia responded Thursday, saying in a press statement, quote, "We are aware of reports that several Liberian government officials had their U.S. visas canceled recently. Under U.S. law, we cannot comment on individual visa cases." The statement went on to say, quote, "The partnership between the United States and Liberia remains strong. We have worked together through many difficult times. We are committed to supporting Liberia and her people as they seek to foster democracy and economic growth and to rebuild the country." Liberia celebrates its 167th independence anniversary tomorrow, Saturday, amid Ebola fear and economic downturn. Jeremiah Solonte, Liberia's ambassador to the United States, says even though the nation is hurting economically and health-wise, 167 years of freedom is enough reason to celebrate. But Ambassador Solonte tells me the nation is observing this Independence Day with heavy hearts for those who are sick and who have lost their lives to Ebola.
We are very grateful to the Almighty for sparing the lives of Liberians and friends of Liberia to be able to see 167 years of existence as a country, as a nation state. Why we celebrate, though, we have some issues of concern in our country. Currently, the government and our people are battling with this deadly Ebola virus that permeated the society and is really affecting our people. So even as we celebrate 167 years, that is our focus. So how can we galvanize support? How can we create awareness that we can find way to eradicate that is spreading so fast among our people?
I understand this year you are moving the celebrations to Philadelphia. Why?
Well, James, as you may be aware, the government of Liberia, even back in Liberia, moves the July 26th from county to county. That is one strategy to take development to the people, to take the government to the people. We thought that as a government representative here, it's only fair to follow suit. Liberians are spread all over the U.S. I mean, Philadelphia, this year we decided to take the July 26th there because the past 2 years I've been here, and every time we plan the July 26th celebration, especially the cultural extravaganza, those who participate in the cultural aspect of the program come from Philadelphia. And so we said, well, this time it's only fair to go to them as well. Besides, Philadelphia had up to about 30,000 Liberians living there. Minnesota got 22,000. Staten Island got 11,000. So we don't think it's fair enough for all of them to leave their area every year to come to Washington.
There are those who say, Your Excellency, that there is not much to celebrate, particularly because of the state of affairs in the country, Liberia. Some people have described it as increase in poverty, the high cost of living, and the increased exchange rate.
Well, again, James, I will not agree with Liberians who think that we should not be celebrating our 167 years as a nation state because there's poverty in Liberia. As I said earlier, you cannot stop celebrating the 102nd anniversary of your grandmother because she's poor, because she's in the bush. I think we should embrace our independence. There have been some gains, even though we got challenges along the way, but there have been some gains since our Civil War, and we should be able to recognize that.
Jeremiah Solonte is Liberia's ambassador to the United States. He was speaking with me in Washington. This year, Slow Food International named a Ugandan as its vice president with a mission to create gardens and promote slow food ideas throughout Africa. As Hilary Hewler reports for VOA from Munkono, Eddie Mukibi is fighting for biodiversity against a political establishment that sees big agribusiness as the answer to African food security.
Next to a small wooden house in Mukono, just east of Kampala, 10-year-old Solomon Walusimbi plucks pea pods from a lush green tangle of creepers.
This is my garden. I plant so many things like peas, carrots, and maize.
Rows of cabbages wind their way beneath passion fruit vines, and tiny red eggplants rub shoulders with the spikes of a rare type of leek. If it looks more colorful than an ordinary farm, Solomon says, this is because he understands the importance of diversity.
If you dig, this one will die and this one will continue growing. And you will continue eating and getting so many things.
This is a lesson Eddie Mukibi, the new vice president of Slow Food International, is working hard to spread among his fellow Ugandans. His mission is to create 10,000 gardens like Solomon's throughout Africa, many in schools, instilling slow food values like biodiversity and food activism in the next generation.
You find little children of 3 to 15 years having a lot of knowledge about the traditional crops, the local crops, the planting seasons and such kind of things. This is what we are achieving with the gardens. The gardens project is very important to reconnect young people like Solomon back to the land.
7 years ago, as an agronomy student, Mukibi was taught to encourage farmers to plant hybrid crops, which he found were ill-equipped to handle Uganda's unpredictable seasons. This is when he realized how important local foods were to food security, he says, and how quickly they were disappearing.
So these are products which are used to the African conditions. Apart from being traditional, when we had a bad season and farmers predicted a bad season, they had a crop for that season. When they predicted an attack of butterflies and insects, they had a potato variety which was resistant to this pest, and everyone was encouraged to plant that. Today we have no choice.
Slow Foods gardeners are encouraged to grow traditional crops that are slowly dying out as the continent's food becomes more and more homogenized. But the movement, promoted in the West by celebrity chefs, is fighting an uphill battle in Africa. Here, says Mukibi, politicians and scientists tend to focus their efforts on developing high-yield varieties of seeds and encouraging big agribusiness to invest. This, he argues, is not the best way to combat hunger. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Mukono.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the IAAF World Junior Athletics Championships in Eugene, Oregon State, in the United States of America. Hadja Sukal clocked 10 minutes and 31.91 seconds to set an Algeria Junior Women's 3,000-meter steeplechase national record on Thursday. On the infield, Egyptian Mohamed Magdi Hamza Khalifa qualified for the finals in men's short put when he heaved the implement to a lifetime best of 19.55 meters. Back on the track, Ghana's Emmanuel Dasor clocked a lifetime best of 20.75 seconds to win his 200-meter heat, while Nigeria's Africa Youth and Junior Champion Divine Oduduru ran 20.89 seconds to also qualify for the 200-meter semifinals. Turning to football, Egypt's Zamalek hosts the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe in mini-league action of the Orange Africa Champions League in Cairo today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Tunisian clubs CS Sfaxien and Esperance face off. On Sunday, the Democratic Republic of Congo's Vita face Sudan's El Hilal as Libya's El Ahli Benghazi play Algeria's Entente Setif. Elsewhere, Zambia's Nkana welcome Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel in Orange Africa Confederations Cup action tomorrow Saturday. The Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports and ASEC Mimosa play Egypt's El Ahli and Cameroon's Cotton Sport respectively. While on Sunday, the Republic of Congo's AC Leopards host Mali's AS Real de Bamako. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We will see you on Monday morning. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, July 25th.
Good morning, Daybreak Africa. This is William Kuklu from Monrovia, Liberia. I wish all Liberians happy independence as we celebrate 167 years of independence on July 26th. Happy independence to all Liberians. I hope we use this day to pray for our nation in fight against this deadly Ebola virus. Thank you and have a great day.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. And that's it for this Friday, July 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying have a lovely weekend, Africa.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa. Wake, 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 wake,
wake. Umaru, wake. This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.